Christine Brennan is one of America's top sports writers and has been for a long, 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 long time. I met her about 20 years ago when she was writing for the Washington Post. She's also written for the Miami Herald, now is a columnist for USA Today, which makes her not only one of the top female sports writers in this country, but probably one of the most read sports writers of either gender. She also appears on ABC and ESPN, and the last time I talked to her, she was on the phone with me from the back seat of a taxi cab in Torino, Italy, where she was covering the Winter Olympics. At the time, I said, you know, when your book comes out, come on the show and we'll talk about it. Well, today her brand new book is out. It is called Best Seat in the House, A Father, A Daughter, A Journey Through Sports. I'm happy to welcome Christine Brennan back to the Paul Harris Show. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. So, first of all, thanks again for doing that stuff from the Olympics for me. I appreciate that.
Well, I was smiling because I was thinking, okay, I was in the back seat of a taxi. I remember it like it was a second ago. And now, because I'm on a book tour and I'm literally going stop to stop, although, you know, you are the most important of all of them today.
Oh, thank you.
I'm in the front seat of a car on my cell phone. So I hope you can hear me okay, because I would have loved to be, you know, stationary. But I guess with us, I always have to be in some kind of vehicle.
Yeah, if we ever do an interview and you're on a landline, something's gone horribly wrong.
That's right. So, and you, I remember I was laughing with you as I was in Italy and you were loving the adventure of it all. And when I hung up with you, I was in the car with a few friends and they were laughing at me and how that all was. And I thought, you know, though, your comments allowed me to reflect again and be the kid in Toledo again. And like, you know, this is so cool. We can get so jaded in our lives. And even the Olympics, you know, there's moments when it becomes almost routine. I can't believe I just said that. But it, even then, because it becomes a level of work and running around and getting no sleep, and you allowed me, with your wonderful comments, to remember that how cool that was, and I did really have a delightful time just enjoying all of that.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for your friendship through the years, and you have been at some of the biggest events, Olympics and Super Bowls and World Series and all that sort of stuff, but in writing the book, it seemed to me like you became little Christy Brennan from Toledo, Ohio, at least inside your own head, long enough to get those thoughts on paper. Is that what happened?
Paul, you're absolutely right. And I was Christy Brennan, and I was, although I was never really little. As my mom said, I was born size 6X, and I kept right on growing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 6 feet tall now, and so, or almost 5'11 and a half, whatever. And so, but yes, I, throughout this book, which was a labor of love, and my folks are now gone, so talking about my mom and dad, it really was a tribute to them as well, Midwestern parents, and doing it the right way and all of that. And I know most of your listeners are nodding their heads because they're those same parents and they're doing the same things as my parents were back in the 60s and 70s. But I do marvel at that, and I try to place myself back there and say, oh, what I would have given as a 10 or 11-year-old girl when I was listening to all the Toledo Mud Hens games on the radio. It wasn't the Cardinals, but it was the Tigers, and I hate to mention 1968 in the World Series, but that was my first initiation really with the Detroit Tigers as a 10-year-old girl when they won the World Series over those fabulous Cardinals. And so, you know, those were the kinds of things, and yeah, I almost transported myself back in time, and that made it more fun to go through the obviously very rigorous process of writing a book.
What I found most interesting as the father of a daughter is I have to keep telling her that she's a 21st century kid. When I was her age, she's almost 12 years old, when I was her age, it was unusual for girls to be involved in sports. It wasn't that there were no girls doing it, but if there was, she was always called the tomboy.
Yeah, that was me. I was the tomboy. And you're right. Absolutely right, Paul. I mean, what I describe in Best Seat in the House, you know, the way I kind of talk about these things, I started to realize you come up with greater themes almost as you start telling anecdotes. And I started to realize I was coming of age as women's sports were coming of age. I was born in 1958. I graduated from high school in 1976. Richard Nixon signed Title IX in 1972. So it really hadn't kicked in yet. The boys had buses for everything, cheerleaders. We had, no cheerleaders. The cheerleaders had better uniforms than we did, the girl athletes at my high school.
There were other girls playing sports?
There were at high school. I was the only one really in the neighborhood as a girl growing up. But once we got to high school, yes, there were. But not a lot. And, you know, we got the worst times in the gym, and we didn't have buses. And if our moms couldn't drive us, we had to cancel games. Can you imagine that now? I mean, there's just no way. And that's how wonderful Title IX and the advancements for the millions of girls and women in sports have been in this country that we have, in the blink of an eye in our nation's history, just 34 years since Richard Nixon signed Title IX, we've had this complete sea change, and this, the playing fields of America are now full of girls. I would have been one of those girls running between soccer matches and baseball games and softball games and everything else, and of course I didn't have any of that till freshman year of high school, so that's how wonderful it is now.
Christine, did your dad force you into playing sports, or were you the one begging him?
I was the one begging him. That's a great question. And in fact, I was kind of pushing for this. I was clamoring to get to Toledo Mud Hens games. I kept score of all the games off the radio, the Toledo Mud Hens, AAA, International League Baseball, Paul, in 1968. Not only was no girl in America probably doing that off of the radio, I dare say very few boys in America were doing all games of minor league baseball, keeping score in their scorebook.
It wow.
Yeah, I was nuts about it. So my dad was a former, they're from Chicago. My folks were from the south side of Chicago. He had a tryout with the Chicago Bears and Papa Bear Hallis way back when. But, you know, he was not pushing me at all. And I'm the oldest of four. So it wasn't older brothers. It was my dad and me and the boys in the neighborhood. But I was the one really saying, come on, I want to see this. So we had season tickets then for the Toledo Mud Hens. Michigan football in the afternoon, season tickets. Only 45 minutes up the road, as you know, from Toledo, and then Toledo, University of Toledo football at night, Mid-American Conference. We do doubleheaders, and this was really my urging. My dad, of course, was thrilled, but no, there was no pushing at all. He was a taskmaster, had to date every piece of paper, could get a grade no lower than the first letter of your last name, B. If you got, I got a D in geometry, one awful, horrifying, first quarter of my freshman year, and we had a wonderful conversation about it, but he was great, and he went in to talk to the teacher, and, of course, that was the only D I ever received, and no Cs, really. So he was a taskmaster, but not as far as sports. Sports, it was to be loved and appreciated for what it was and to have fun with it, which I, of course, thank him forever on that because he gave me that perspective that I still have today.
How did you learn to keep score?
A couple of things. My dad taught me, but Frank Gilhooly, the voice of the Toledo Mud Hens, who, by the way, Paul, is still the voice of the Toledo Mud Hens.
Wow!
I threw out a first pitch at the Mud Hens game 2 weeks ago in Toledo and went up and did an inning and a half with Frank Gilhooly, now 82 years old, and of course pointed out in the book where he is and how I'm listening to him. And sure enough, he taught me. When he said 6-4-3 double play back in 68, I had to figure that out. I was like, 6-4-3. And then I asked my dad, and of course he was helping me keep score, and the numbers, 6, shortstop, 4, second base, 3, first base. And sure enough, 2 weeks ago, talk about full circle, Frank Gilhooly at one point in a half, I was in the booth with him, says 6-4-3, double play. It was the coolest thing. I just loved it.
Now, Frank's been doing those games all those years, but I'm guessing a triple-A team doesn't send him on the road all the time. Was there a time when he was staying home and doing recreations of games?
You are right on. Yes, indeed. He was, and there was another fellow whose name escapes me who was. And at first, I thought they traveled. So I was listening to this game from Syracuse or Rochester, and to me, in Toledo, these were faraway places I wanted to see someday.
Yeah.
Richmond, Tidewater, you know, these were these amazing, and you had the imagination. There was no TV. You didn't get the news. You didn't see what the uniforms looked like, the stadium. You never saw it, ever, as you know. So it was all imagination, very much like Jack Buck and of course, in St. Louis, and what kids grew up with in St. Louis with KMOX and all those years. And so I was, yeah, so anyway, so I thought it was, they were there. And then my father explained to me, he said, listen to the crowd noise. And one inning, and then the next inning, and it was the same. And so I realized, but it didn't make me sad or dishearten me. If anything, it made me intrigued to figure out which games were live and which games were canned in the studio.
The book is called Best Seat in the House, Christine Brennan. It's about her dad and herself and her journey through sports to become one of America's top sports writers. One of the things, Christine, that intrigued me as I was reading the book, and has always intrigued me about you, is you probably will deny this, but you really are a role model for other women and girls who might be interested in doing it, because as we were talking, you came up at a time when no girls were doing what you were doing and no women were doing what you were doing. Although I will tell you, when I went to college, and you and I are just about the same age, you're 2 months older than I am. So when I went to college in the mid-70s, I went to the college, and the first week I went to the radio station because I wanted to work there, and I met the sports director, and it was a person you know, Rachel Schuster.
Oh, my goodness.
who, of course, became one of the sports directors at USA Today, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's one of the editors, and I deal with her all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrific.
She was the sports director there, and I remember here I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, walking in and going, what do you mean a woman is the sports director of this radio station? Which, as you know, because you know Rachel, that attitude around her lasts 4 seconds.
Exactly, maybe 3, maybe 2.5.
So, you know, you and Rachel were doing this kind of on parallel paths, but who were your role models? Who could you look up to and go, I want to be like her? There wasn't anybody, was there?
No, there wasn't. And I never read a woman's sports byline until I went to Northwestern in 76, and then the sports editor of the Daily Northwestern was a woman, actually, right then. Helene Elliott, now with the Los Angeles Times, covers hockey, has for years. I never saw a woman doing sports on TV, except at the Olympics, with, say, Donna DeVerona, who is one of my good friends to this day, or Phyllis Schwartz, who, of course, was on the NFL Today. But as you know, Paul, her career path was Miss America to television, and that was not going to be my career path. So that really wasn't much of a role model for me. Phyllis George wasn't. So there really was none. And that, I think that's why I always thought I'd cover politics. And I say in the book, I talk about how going to Northwestern, I always thought I'd be a political reporter. And how strange is that a girl who loved sports as much as I did and went to so many games with my father and my siblings and my mom on occasion, you know, would think she was going to cover politics, wouldn't even think of sports. So I tell kids today, and I talk to students all the time and email and go to classes and travel around giving speeches, and every single time I say, whatever you've got inside of you as a kid, if you're a teenager, I knew that I wanted to be a journalist by age 13 or 14, but nothing could have sounded stranger in the suburbs of Toledo, Ohio, middle America in the early to mid-70s than a girl saying she wanted to be a sports writer, proving that you can do anything, because that was as weird as it would have gotten. And I also vowed to hope to try to be the role model that I never had by speaking out and by talking to students and leading the Association for Women in Sports Media and starting a scholarship fund. Not because I'm so great at all, but because it's so important to give back. And I realized what I didn't have because of my parents, I still pursued it. Because they said, honey, you can do anything you want. So my mom and dad said it, and I felt I could, even though we didn't have that role model. But now, so many kids don't have quite that wonderful set of parents or quite that encouragement. Maybe it's a one-parent home. So I do believe it's important, and that's why I speak out and try to speak as much as I do.
And I think one of the great messages in the book is not just to read about your remarkable career, but that parents do exactly that. Say to their kids, whether they're boys or girls, look, if this is what you really want, let's figure out how to make that happen. You're going to have to work hard at getting it, because working hard is certainly part of the ethic that you grew up with and is shown in this book and in your career, but also parents who were supportive of that and able to point you in the right direction.
Right. Oh, yeah. And again, if it sounds weird and strange, you look at kids and I really say, think inside it when I talk to a class. Right now, what inside of you, don't have to say it, but think it. What would you love to do as a career to get paid for? I said, for me, that was sports writing, sports journalism. I never thought I could, ever, because I never had that female role model. I didn't know that women could do any of this stuff. But I had that passion. And then once I started to see it at Northwestern, and then with some summer internships, that women could and that I could get jobs and start doing this and get paid to do what most people pay to do, go to sporting events, that's when I, of course, was hooked and haven't looked back 25 years later.
I first met Christine something like 20 years ago. I was working in Washington, D.C. at the time, and so was she. I was on the air there doing a morning show, and she was the Redskins beat writer for the Washington Post, which also made her one of the first women to go into a locker room full of 300-pound naked men.
Oh, I love the way you describe that. Yes. You know what? My dad, when he asked me, I said, Dad, I keep eye contact at all times. I see the whites of their eyes.
How difficult was it? I mean, the day you know you're going in there, how difficult was that day for you?
Actually, I was in Miami. It was Miami Herald. I was just an intern there, Paul, in 1980. And it was the Minnesota Vikings playing the Dolphins in a preseason game. And they were sending me, Miami Herald was sending me into the Minnesota Vikings locker room. Not only was it the first time I'd ever been in a men's locker room doing my job as a reporter, but it was the first time the Vikings had ever had a woman in their locker room, I found out later, which was potentially far worse. 4 years earlier at Northwestern, the issue of co-ed dorms had been a big deal with my parents and me, and now I'm walking into a room full of naked men. Bud Grant, you remember Bud Grant, the venerable coach of the Minnesota Vikings? I interviewed him. Gradually, others, reporters were there. They peeled away into the locker room. I did wear a skirt. I tried to be as neon signish as possible. You know, I'm a woman, here I come. You know, to let people know, not to do anything other than just to let players be aware that, you know, very conservatively dressed, but that, you know, this was unusual. I was very respectful of their turf and their space, and always have been.
Yeah, you weren't there to gawk, you were there to talk.
Right, there you go. Get some interviews and get the heck out of there. It's not sexy or exciting. It's where we do our job. And most male sports writers tell me they don't like it either. But a few whoops and hollers that day in the summer of 1980. Most of the Vikings were great. A couple of folks came up and said, hey, who do you need? How can I help you? Which was just, they were godsends. But, you know, I just got the quotes, got out of there. One guy, you know, demanded basically to be naked in front of me. But then I learned something very interesting. I happened to have an 8x11 notebook that I was carrying that day, Paul, and that 8x11 notebook, with the way I held it, was perfectly positioned. And I looked down at the piece of paper, and so forevermore I would carry 8.5x11 notebooks into men's locker rooms.
You talk in the book about some of the people you encountered and some of their attitudes in there, and I love the stories, but I would like you to share one of them with my listeners, which is the wonderful Dave Butts. He's from the St. Louis area.
Yes.
He was a giant of a defensive lineman for the Redskins.
Right, Dave Butts, of course, is a great Purdue star. But you're right from there, and 6'7", 300 pounds. Dave Butts, early on, he was a veteran at the time, a long time NFL star. And I come in the locker room, and he calls me over right off the bat, and he says, "Are you going to be in this locker room when I'm naked?" And I said, "Well, I guess, you know, it's up to you." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, then I think you should be naked, too." I said, "Dave, that's not how it works." But that was the beginning, Paul, of a wonderful relationship where we just, you know, he would tease me, he would get on my case, he would be impossible to deal with. And then sure enough, he'd call me over to make sure he'd heard a rumor that someone was bothering me in the locker room to make sure that everything was okay.
Yeah, he stood up for you, didn't he?
He sure did. He was like a big brother. As I say, at one point, I said, he was like a big brother, a weird big brother. but there was a perfect example. He had the flu, and he was sick, and he lost a lot of weight. He'd been in the hospital. And he checked himself out of the hospital in time to play in a big game. So I wanted to find out how much weight he lost, you know, while he had this terrible flu bug. Well, I come up to him, and he looks at me. He says, "I don't speak to you in the locker room." And Dave, I'm just trying to get this fact correct. Was it, you know, Joe Gibbs said it was 20 pounds. Is that correct? Well, then I see the top, you remember Frank Herzog from Channel 7, the ABC affiliate, and
yep,
the voice of the Redskins at the time. Frank comes up. He's walking up to Dave. And I look at Frank. I was not going to be denied by my friend and tormentor, Dave Butts. So I looked at Frank. I said, "Hey, Frank, could you ask Dave how many pounds he lost in the hospital?" Frank Herzog, "Dave, how many pounds did you lose in the hospital?" Dave looks at Frank, answers, "About 21. With that, I look at Frank, I write that down, I thank Frank, look at Dave, smile, and walk away. So I got my answer because Dave wouldn't speak to me, Dave Butts, so I had him, a TV sportscaster. It was the most ridiculous little ploy and game I'd ever been a part of, but two could play the game. And, you know, again, I knew I was on their turf, I knew he was testing me, and Dave and I got along great after he retired, and I actually need to call him because I want to tell him about the book, and I think he was one of my favorite people to deal with, partially because he kept me on my toes.
Yeah. We talked before, Christine, about how you didn't have any women who could be role models for a woman who wanted to be a sports writer. That means that at some point a man had to take you under his wing and kind of show you the ropes. Who was that?
Well, certainly sports editors that hired me, Paul Anger at the Miami Herald, George Solomon at the Washington Post. Without them, you know, I think any woman would say this in a man's world. You have to have men supporting you. These were great, open-minded people who, in the case of George Solomon at the Washington Post, you know, told Pete Rozelle of the NFL, "Hey, we need to get this locker room policy fixed because we're putting Christine Brennan on the Washington Redskins." And those were the days when the Cardinals were in St. Louis, spent a lot of time at Bush Memorial Stadium. And you know, that was just the way it was. There also was a man named Shelby Strother, who died of liver cancer a good 12, 15 years ago now, but who was a mentor to me, a Vietnam vet, long hair, completely opposite, kind of a, you know, counterculture guy, totally opposite of my Midwest Toledo, you know, Republican, you know, background that I had. And here was Shelby teaching me the ropes, showing me what it was like to write in a different way, a more fluid style. I really wanted to read everything he wrote so I could learn from him. Another big brother type. and also in the locker room. At this point, the Florida Gators would not allow me in the locker room, covering in 81 and 82 for the Miami Herald, Paul. And so Shelby would make sure I didn't miss anything, check quotes with me later. You know, here's what somebody said in case you didn't get him, because they would bring players out to me. I'd be standing in the loading dock by myself. Not exactly the ideal working situation, but we worked with through the system and worked in the system to do to try to get it done right. But Shelby always took care of me and really made sure that it is equally as possible. So I have to give him a lot of credit, too.
As we mentioned at the top of the interview, the last time I talked to you, you were in Torino, Italy, covering the Olympics. And, of course, you were there for the Nancy Kerrigan-Tonya Harding thing, which you became the go-to person on that story because you were right there in the heart of it. But you've been covering the Olympics for so long, and you write about the book in the book about remembering the Olympics back to the Munich Massacre in 1972. How are the Olympics different? Are they still fun?
They're still fun, but I will say, you know, we talked from Torino, as you said, and to me that was the most lackluster Olympics I've been to, and I've been so lucky to go to 12 in a row since L.A. in 84. So I'm, you know, I'm just so fortunate that's my quote-unquote work, you know, to go to the Olympics. So I'm not saying it was still wonderful, but I think the specialness has worn off, Paul, you know, the fact that they're every other year. So we have the Athens Games, and then a year and a half later we have the Torino Olympics. People are confused. What Olympics, summer, winter, you know, all that. I also think having professional athletes in the way we do, and maybe some of these sports that are X game sports that are trying to attract new viewers, the snowboard cross and some of that, you know, especially the skiing and the more X games kind of things. While it's interesting to a lot of people, I'm not sure, the short track speed skating. I'm not sure, Paul, that is going to keep the grandmothers and the moms and the families who have been always the kind of the core audience of the Olympics. I think that's why we're seeing the TV ratings drop, plus the fact the Internet gives you the results. My goodness, I think Sasha Cohen finally skated on NBC at 11:30 Eastern, 10:30, you know, in Central Time. Well, that was 8 hours after she'd fallen, you know, twice in the first 30 seconds, and everyone knew that from the Internet. So NBC needs to figure out a way to make it, have it live, and then maybe package it beautifully in the evening for those who want to watch a beautiful show as opposed to just get the results.
Yeah, I think the TV coverage is actually more responsible than the other things you mentioned there, because in the efforts of NBC to stretch things out and keep you in suspense, as you point out, we live in a world where the suspense is easily taken up by, you know, the announcements on our newscasts and sportscasts in the afternoon here on KMOX, and people can find out online and in so many other places, that to stretch it out, if they actually did it in a more linear style, hey, tonight we're going to have the women figure skaters, and you could actually watch one right after the other and actually see the competition and get caught up in the competition, I think that might rebuild some of the viewership for them.
Oh, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I do think you asked, though, a very good question about the Olympics. I still think it's the best thing we've got going, high school sports and certainly like minor, you know, college sports. I mean, all for the love of it. Most Olympic athletes don't get rich and famous. They don't make millions. And they do it for all the right reasons. And they do it once, and then they're gone. You know, they go back to their lives. They drop into our lives for 2 weeks, never overstay their welcome. I can think of a certain baseball player in San Francisco who's definitely overstayed his welcome in sports right now. And, you know, when you think of these Olympic athletes, they are doing it for the right reasons. So I think there's so much good in the Olympics, like high school sports, like college sports and college athletes do it, and even pros, you know, for the right reasons. People give back and love sports and also probably know they're going to go on to another career and be parents and do all those important things later. So I do think the games, but I agree with you. I think NBC has got to figure out a way to give you the results the way the rest of our communication world giving us the results, which is instantaneously.
You alluded to Barry Bonds there. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask your opinion. Here he is on the cusp of catching and passing Babe Ruth to become number two to Hank Aaron on the all-time home run list. What do you think of this whole controversy, and does an asterisk have to go in the record book?
I wish an asterisk would. I wish he'd get wiped out of the record books. But we haven't put an asterisk by all the East German swimming records or track and field records and all those gold medals that were won by women who were cheating at the Olympic Games, and men, too. So, you know, that's a tough call. I think Barry Bonds will be seen as one of the great cheaters of our era. I think fans in baseball, maybe now, but certainly in 15, 20 years, will look back on this era, sadly, as the steroid era. Certainly Mark McGuire with Andrew Steen-Dione, even though it was legal at the time, clearly that is a real blemish on what he did in 98 in the Great Home Run Derby. We all loved it. Now we know a lot more about it. But I think knowledge is good. And even in, you know, St. Louis, where I know McGuire was such a hero and probably still is to a lot of people, I think to tell our kids what's right and wrong, it's tough with Barry Bonds. And thankfully, though, the coverage has been much better now. Almost every story you hear about the Balco thing and about him being under investigation. It is the perfect storm for baseball, Paul. You know, they didn't drug test for years. Their head was in the sand. The Olympics started drug testing in 1972. Baseball started testing and punishing in 2004. Just abysmal. And so now they've got the two most beautiful marks, numbers in sports, 755 and 714, under attack by a man who we know, we just know, the evidence is overwhelming, has cheated for years. And it's a shame. I wish he'd retire for the good of the game. But I kind of hope he does it on the road so he gets booed, because that's, I believe, exactly the way we should treat Barry Bonds.
Well, I think he's going to probably pass Babe Ruth this week, and they just started a 7-game homestand in San Francisco, so he'll probably do it there. But wouldn't that be remarkable if later on this afternoon he said, you know what, I'm quitting at 7:13. I'm happy being number three. It'll never happen, but, you know, you talk about McGuire. It's still scandalous to me that here in St. Louis we've got 5 miles of Interstate 70 that say Mark McGuire Highway.
I know. It's terrible. And you wish for the day when the old days, when athletes would just say, no, I did wrong, I retire, I quit, I shouldn't be a part of this. But Barry Bonds has not one bone like that in his body. So why would we ever expect him to have that grace and dignity now? At least McGuire got off Andro, you know, when he realized kids were on it. But yeah, I mean, his performance last year was just so sad. I felt bad for the fans of St. Louis. You know, what great fans. Probably the best baseball fans on earth. And to have this, the truth come out, or at least some sense of what McGuire was doing and the cheating he was doing, or at least the substance enhancing, you know, using that he was doing. It's just so sad. Again, but I also say, hey, it's better that we know. We can use that knowledge to teach our kids and hopefully be better off for it as a society, as a culture. But it's tough, and it's tough right now to be a great sports fan, a baseball fan, with all the stuff that's going on with this sport. Hopefully they'll clean it up, but I think the Olympics has been trying for, 34 years, and I haven't caught all the cheaters, so baseball has a long way to go, unfortunately.
Christine Brennan, one of America's best and most read sports writers. She's in USA Today every week, and she's now in print with a brand new book just out today, just in time for her birthday, called Best Seat in the House, A Father, a Daughter, a Journey Through Sports. I know your dad's not around anymore, but I'm sure he was incredibly proud of the career that you built for yourself, and if he were here today, he'd be very proud of what you've done in print yet again, and I congratulate you on that.
Well, Paul, thanks. Yeah, Father's Day especially, we're thinking, oh, it's, whatever, but thank you. He was a wonderful man, and I owe everything I've done to him and to my mom, so thank you for those kind words, and it's always a delight to be on with you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Christine Brennan here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.